I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Philadelphia City Councilman at Large Alan Dom does not want serving on council to be a lifetime job. He introduced legislation last week that would limit members to 3 consecutive 4-year terms, in other words, 12 years total. All 17 members of City Council face the voters every 4 years, and most of them do get reelected and get to keep their jobs. The longest-serving member on council is Brian O'Neill, who's been there since 1979. With the primary just a few months away, will this bill, which would require a change in the city charter, be on the ballot? We asked Julia Taruso to join us. She's a staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Julia, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, term limits, yes or no, especially if you live in Philadelphia, call us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Julia, let's start with Councilman Dom's resolution. What does it say?
So the resolution would call for no more than 3 consecutive 4-year terms for council members. It would exempt the current council members who, you know, were elected under a policy that did not have any council terms.
Right.
And since it would require a change in the city charter, what council is really voting on is whether to put this question to voters on the May primary ballot. So right now it does not look like he has the support. It was just introduced last week, so that could potentially shift, but it's not looking too positive.
Not looking too positive. Nonetheless, was this a surprise? And what was his thinking behind introducing this bill?
I think this is sort of a perennial issue in Philadelphia because district, specifically the 10 council members who represent districts, geographic neighbor areas of the city, do so often win re-election. It's a topic that's come up before. It's a bill was introduced in 2011 by former Councilman Wilson Good to do this. A difference was that bill would have applied to the council members that were serving then, and that did not go anywhere. I think it was a bit of a surprise that it was introduced now, but I think the timing, the ideas to, you know, if it moves forward, to get it on the May primary ballot, and that's a pretty tight window. So if it was going to happen in time for that, it had to be introduced.
So the idea of introducing more competition in the election process here in Philadelphia?
Exactly. Yeah. I think, as you mentioned, Councilman O'Neill has served since 1979.
Yeah. 40 years.
40 years. There's Councilwoman Blackwell has represented West Philadelphia for, I think, 27. Council President Daryl Clark has been on council for 19. And there are a number of other council members who have already mm-hmm. running for a fourth term. There's been much written about how difficult it can be to challenge an incumbent district council member. You know, they have the benefit of having done constituent work for a lot of, fundraising is also a challenge. A lot of times these are party-supported candidates mm-hmm. who have fundraised a lot in the run-up.
Councilman Don, he's an at-large candidate and running for his second
term. Yep, his second term.
Mm-hmm. Are the races for at-large candidates more competitive than the more district candidates?
I would say it's different because ballot position matters so much if you're an at-large candidate.
And you mean literally on the ballot?
Literally on the ballot. So typically a district in a district race, you might, with some exceptions, you might only have 1 or 2 challengers. So and you're campaigning in a smaller geographic area. At large, you're campaigning all over the city, and you're kind of at the mercy, if you don't have name recognition, of where you land on the ballot, which is a mm-hmm. randomized process. So in some ways you can get lucky, and I think there's more turnover in the at-large, but they both have different challenges.
As you said, this was introduced last week, and we've got lots of comments coming in, which is terrific, and I will read them in just a moment or two. You said this was introduced last week and seemed to indicate that it might go nowhere. What is the process of moving something like this forward?
So the resolution would have to get a hearing in which there would be more debate about it. And then it would need, since it requires a charter change, it actually needs 2/3 of the council to pass. So Dom would need 12 mm-hmm. yes votes. And if he got those, then it would go on the primary ballot. I haven't heard that there's been a hearing scheduled yet.
Right, right. And based on some of your reporting,
yeah,
looks like it doesn't have the kind of future that Dom would expect or hope for it.
Yeah, I was surprised that the day it was introduced, I went around and talked to a number of council members who said flat out that this is not something they would support. I think I talked to 5. And the ideas ranged from, you know, it's actually undemocratic. I think Councilman O'Neill said, you know, you're giving the voters fewer people to vote for if you do this. Others said, you know, we have term limits; they're called elections. So that's kind of the opposition, and that experience really does matter. But I think what we're hearing on the pro side is that 12 years is a sufficient amount of time to be able to make a difference.
Interestingly, the Philadelphia Inquirer's editorial yesterday really pushing for getting this on the ballot, and they made an interesting argument, which is, but if you put it on the ballot, you are putting it to the voters to decide whether mm-hmm. to have term limits or not.
Yeah, that's very true.
Let me read a comment from Diana. Yes, all politicians should have term limits so they're not beholden to donors but to their constituents. This should include local, state, and federal politicians. Looks like Dan has a similar comment, but let's see what Dan from Fishtown has to say. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello there.
Hi there. Go ahead.
I support a 20-year term limit. I think any legislator or city council person should be given the opportunity to represent a generation of their constituents. I also think 20 years might be more palatable to some of the city council members who are, you know, on the no side of this issue. You know, that's really, I think that's much more reasonable.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And interestingly, I don't know whether you've had a chance to sort of find out, Julia, how the public feels about this. We got 2 comments here, slightly different. How do you think this might play among voters in Philadelphia?
I think there has been, back when it was introduced in 2011, I think there was some polling done that Philadelphians favored, you know, exploring term limits. I have heard, you know, some arguments that 5 of the current council members have been serving since before new voters were born. And that speaks to that caller's generational comment. So.
Right.
And just anecdotally, I've gotten a lot of responses that are favorable after writing the article.
And just to underscore what you said earlier, Brian O'Neill, 10 terms, Janie Blackwell, 7, Daryl Clark and Blondell Reynolds Brown, although she's retiring, or not running, 5. And then Curtis Jones and Maria Quinones Sanchez and William Greenlee, 3. So just for listeners to have a sense of how people do stay in these particular mm-hmm. jobs. Was there an argument made, well, look at all the other big cities, Chicago being the only other one besides Philly that doesn't have term limits?
Right. So Los Angeles, Houston, New York City, they all they have term limits for their council members. We're also, I think, one of the only cities that has that has term limits for the mayor, but not for city council. So I think that is one of the main arguments, you know, why aren't we doing what so many other cities have done?
So if this goes nowhere, it just goes nowhere? I mean, is that how the process works?
Yeah, I do think, you know, if you look at the number of people running this election season, and there's a lot of reasons
right.
that people are getting more involved, It's possible we see some natural shakeup on council, but we don't know what's going to happen with the election.
Here's a comment from Phil. He says, it seems obvious that this is just a publicity stunt for Dom, who's running for re-election. Obviously, it won't go anywhere on council. But in the meantime, you get a whole episode of Radio Times devoted to an image of him as a bold outsider. To you, Phil, we haven't described him as a bold outsider. We're just describing something that he introduced and an issue that has been introduced before by Wilson Good Jr., but just to underscore that. But I think an interesting comment.
No, a valid comment. I think the reason it's getting the attention it's getting is because it is an issue that has come up before, because we are entering an election season where, people are talking a lot about the challenges that incumbents face specific to Philadelphia.
Would he apply? Do we know if he will apply this to himself, whether there's a charter change or not?
I don't know that. That'd be a very good question to
ask. Whether, and he's running for his second term.
He is running for his second term, yeah.
A comment from a listener. For term limits, you need to look at the learning curve to know city government, and on the other point, the time at which it becomes more of a fiefdom than service. I'm a former Philadelphia resident. And I think that is the issue, whether, serving for X number of years makes you an expert, or whether that just makes you an incumbent that gets too comfortable.
Right. And you hear it on both sides that it takes a while to kind of get to know the players and how to get things done, or that you become kind of complacent.
Right. You're covering the upcoming May primary. Anything on the horizon that looks different? And there's some interesting races there.
I would say the main thing is that there's at least 30 people that have already expressed interest in running for council at large. So you're going to see a lot of people running for council. And then in the district races, all 10 district council members have a challenger. In 2015, only two wound up having challengers. So I think you'll see more contested races. Although one of the arguments that someone made for term limits is that I think in the last four election cycles, out of something like 80 district races, only a very small percentage, I think only like 10 had been competitive, meaning 10 points or less.
Interesting. And what are some of the hot issues you think that will be part of any of these councilmanic races?
Well, just last week, we saw a couple of protests that dealt with councilmanic prerogative, which is sort of, not what you're used to seeing people protesting in Philadelphia. But it's this idea that district council members, the races we're talking about, have final say on land use in their districts and how they're using and dispensing land, especially given the building boom we're in, is a really powerful right afforded to them. It's not a law, but it's just kind of this general rule that they have final say on vacant land use, on zoning. So I think that'll be a big issue.
And a surprising one, it sounds like, too.
A little bit, just because it's more of a it's a little wonkier than you would expect.
Yeah,
but
when you really
explore what it means, I think it makes a lot of sense, because it really comes down to the power that council members have.
Well, Julia Truso, thanks for coming in and joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. She's a staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And we're going to be talking about New Jersey after this very short break. In fact, talking about an interesting and kind of wonky issue in New Jersey as well, having to do with online gambling. Do stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Online gambling is relatively new, legalized in New Jersey just a few years ago, and now generating some serious money for casinos in Atlantic City and tax revenue for the state. But a decision by the Justice Department this January could change all that because of a new reading of the Federal Wire Act that prohibits betting across state lines. Now, the Obama administration had interpreted the act differently, opening the door to internet wagering, and now operators face an uncertain future. They have until mid-April to comply with the Trump administration's interpretation of the law. We asked John Reitmeier to join us, and he is budget and public finance reporter for NJ Spotlight. John, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So how lucrative has online gambling been for New Jersey?
It got off to a slow start after it became legal in 2013, but the gross revenues that were just generated in 2018 totaled around $350 million. So it's become a rare growth industry for New Jersey. And in terms of tax revenue, that's translated into about $50 to $60 million in tax revenue for the state budget, which is a welcomed revenue since New Jersey has some pretty significant budget problems. So it, just within a few years, it really has taken hold. And with the adoption of sports betting last year, legalized sports betting, some of that activity also occurs online. And so that's providing another boost. And the figures for sports betting have been pretty robust as well. So a lot of momentum in this area right now happening.
So good for Atlantic City, good for the casinos in Atlantic City?
It's something that local officials have pointed to as part of an ongoing recovery in Atlantic City. And so there's been a lot happening in the wake of the Great Recession. And online gambling has been one of those activities that's considered to be part of the recovery for Atlantic City and some good things that are starting to happen there.
Let me ask you some really basic questions because I don't gamble online. But do you have to, in New Jersey, do you have to go to Atlantic City in order to gamble online?
You don't, but the way that the law was written is the actual infrastructure has to be based in Atlantic City or affiliated with an Atlantic City casino. And so that's why Atlantic City gets a boost out of this, because I could be sitting at a desk in Trenton and playing poker against somebody and the transactions occurring in some way through Atlantic City, but you actually don't have to be in Atlantic City to gamble online in New Jersey.
You can be in Pennsylvania, right?
some of the games work, you could be playing across state lines even with residents of different states.
So are other states, including Pennsylvania, getting in on the action here?
I know Pennsylvania is one of the states I'm aware of that has legalized gambling. And in fact, there was a letter that New Jersey's attorney general sent to the Trump administration within the last few weeks that questioned this policy decision, and the Attorney General for Pennsylvania also signed on to that letter, basically seeking more information about why this decision was made and stressing that it would have a negative impact in New Jersey and also likewise for Pennsylvania.
John, help us understand what, and it is a little complicated. It took me a couple of readings to kind of figure out what is going on here. But help us understand what the Justice Department under the Trump administration, how they are, I guess, interpreting this Federal Wire Act.
Yeah, sure. This goes back to the 1960s, and it was a law that was written, my understanding is, to try and give prosecutors another tool to fight illegal sports gambling rings that were going across state lines. And so in 2011, the Obama administration, as online gambling was becoming a possibility and states like New Jersey were starting to become interested in allowing it, the Obama administration issued a interpretation of the Wire Act that was very narrow, that basically said this is intended to stop sports gambling over state lines. And remember, the internet was not around in the 60s, and they didn't think about ways that, you know, it would be a lot easier to do gambling activities over state lines. And so the difference came sort of out of nowhere earlier this year, where the Trump administration decided that it was going to read that Wire Act more broadly and to say, not only does this apply to sports gambling across state lines, really it applies to all gambling across state lines. Mm. And one of the questions that's been raised is whether this impacts big lotteries that occur, like Powerball, where you are buying into jackpots that are, you know, people across the country are participating in. The interpretation, the Trump administration's interpretation of the Wire Act seems to apply to those types of activities as well. And so it's really upset this industry to figure out how exactly to adapt to, again, this more broad interpretation of a law that goes back to the 1960s before the internet was even invented. And the challenge is in two ways. So some of it occurs, like maybe there's a poker game that's occurring and someone in Pennsylvania is playing someone in New Jersey and a whole bunch of people. That's clearly happening over state lines.
Sure.
But the other threat is because of the internet technology and the infrastructure in general, guaranteeing that the key is across state lines. So guaranteeing that, say, someone who's gambling online in Cherry Hill, that their internet connection wouldn't bounce to a server in Pennsylvania because of the need for speed online. It would be really difficult, and likewise for someone in North Jersey, that there wouldn't be a server that would be triggered across the border in New York to make sure it's happening quickly, that you would be able to guarantee that that activity wouldn't in some way trigger something that happens across state lines. And
wow.
So that's the real challenge, is how do you adapt to what seems to be an abrupt change in federal policy?
Well, let me ask you a couple of follow-up questions there. I mean, the original Federal Wire Act was going after illegal gambling, and now since gambling is so legal across the country, is that an issue, do you think? And I should say that the Attorney General in New Jersey did challenge what the Trump administration is trying to do.
Yeah, and I think so. The problem is, when we look at the wording of this law that, again, goes back decades, even before gambling was legal in New Jersey, in Atlantic City.
Right.
And to think about what were they thinking at the time and what were they intending to prevent? And there's a lot of case law, and that was the root of the Obama administration's decision, was to say, looking at court decisions and to say, look, here's our best analysis of how this has evolved, and we think that this law was originally targeted just to stop this problem that was occurring at the time,
right,
with gambling predominantly on sports that was happening across state lines. And so the key is the wording of if the wording of that law had been a little more artful.
That was an artfully chosen word there, John. Yes, I get it.
We may not be where we are today because it would have eliminated any doubt.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's John Reitmeier, and he's a budget and public finance reporter for NJ Spotlight, talking about an interesting, I guess, challenge to an interpretation the Obama administration had about the Federal Wire Act, and it did open the door to sports gambling in Atlantic City or in New Jersey and gambling across state lines. The Trump administration has chosen to reinterpret that law differently, and now it looks like some of these operators face an uncertain future. Interested in your questions and your comments? That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. John, does this pit kind of bricks and mortar casinos against casinos that are getting into the online gambling business? And I ask that because reading your article and several other articles in preparation for today's show, I kept running across Sheldon Adelson's name. Can you fold him into our conversation here?
Absolutely. And so that's the looming issue here, is obviously Sheldon Adelson's a big contributor to Republican causes and to President Trump himself. And he's for years pushed. Initially, the effort was launched in Congress. I don't cover Congress on a regular basis, but I did some research and found a bill that had been kicking around but never made it to the finish line, that sought to undo the Obama administration's more narrow interpretation of the Wire Act and to put more controls. You know, there are, to be fair, there are people who are concerned that this opening up of online gambling has made it easier for someone who has a gambling addiction,
sure,
to get into big trouble. And also there were issues raised about young people participating probably at an age where they shouldn't in online gambling, and how many protections were in place to make sure that they were prevented from doing so. At some point, the effort seems to have shifted, and that's one of the issues that New Jersey's attorney general is looking into, asking for any communications between Adelson or one of his lobbyists and the Justice Department. I should also note that this occurred when the power structure in the Justice Department was in flux. There was an acting attorney general. He took that position sort of outside of the conventional succession process. Now there's a new attorney general who has been confirmed by the U.S. Senate. And so we'll have to see whether he pursues the same policy. This isn't due to be enforced until, as you mentioned before, until April. And so we're sort of waiting to see whether the new attorney general has the same zeal for this issue as the acting attorney general when this occurred. But certainly the idea would be if I'm gambling online somewhere, then that's potentially preventing me from driving. Now, in Atlantic City, it's mitigated to an extent because of the law that links it, the activity to Atlantic City. But the idea would be that you might lose some customers for your brick-and-mortar casino if somebody has the convenience on a cold, rainy day or snowy day to just gamble, play poker right from their laptop rather than drive to the brick-and-mortar location. And so that was one of the concerns that's been raised, although what you heard in this legislative effort that didn't quite make it were concerns about underage and gambling addictions. Right.
And it seems like anytime we talk about legalized gambling, there are all these various other complications. I'm curious, John, if this is upheld and the Trump administration's interpretation of the Federal Wire Act holds, will it put then online gambling out of business?
So the experts that I've talked to have indicated this will most likely become a court battle before we see any major shakeup. And I wouldn't be surprised. I spoke recently with Senator Ray Lesniak, retired state senator, but he was the sponsor of the bill that became the 2013 online gambling law. He was also instrumental in the litigation that led to the legalization of sports betting. And so he's been asked by the current Senate president in New Jersey, Steve Sweeney, to get involved in this issue and sort of represent the state Senate. And a letter that was just sent within the last week or so to the Department of Justice by Senator Lesniak read almost like a legal brief in the sense that it was citing all the different cases involving online gambling. And whether it's Senator Lesniak, whether it's the Attorney General himself, who has not been bashful about suing the Trump administration over a number of different issues, including immigration and environmental issues, or whether it's the casinos or the providers that join together, or maybe Pennsylvania. New Jersey has a lot to lose if this whole industry gets upset by this policy. 50 to 60 million in tax revenue doesn't sound like a whole lot, but New Jersey has a very narrow margin when it comes to the budget. It's underfunding the public employee pension system, school funding law, you name it, the state's got money problems. And so every dollar of the revenue stream matters when it comes to the state budget.
I mean, it seems that was the argument from the state attorney general, saying that in this letter to the Justice Department, the new policy would be harmful for the, quote, public good because of the kind of revenue that the government, whether you like it or not, gets from gambling.
Yeah, and I think you can make this argument full circle back to Atlantic City, where we sort of started. And you, again, the lawmakers who represent that region are on high alert. And, this, again, has been an activity that they think has contributed to some good things that are happening in recent years down there. And so I'm sure whatever party you belong to, you want to see Atlantic City do well, and you want to see the South Jersey economy do well. And so part of that letter, I think, is trying to get a point, the message that think about as you pursue this, think about some of the ramifications and maybe unintended consequences, especially for a president who knows what it's like to operate a casino in Atlantic City, knows the challenges pretty well.
A little irony there is they're not, or perhaps go out of business in Atlantic City. Do you see this then all ending up in the courts, or perhaps, I mean, that seems like the inevitable direction here, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, no, I absolutely, based on the experts that I've talked to, I would expect this. It'll just be a matter of who the litigants, who starts the lawsuit. But I would expect before this gets enforced, or when it starts to be enforced, that there would be some sort of a legal challenge It's just going to be a matter of who actually files that lawsuit. But absolutely, that would be my prediction at this point.
I read that people could have bet on the Oscars. Can you bet on anything in New Jersey now?
You know, that one, I should have looked into that one more closely myself because, and again, I'm not a, I actually grew up right near Atlantic City, but I'm not a big gambler, and I thought sports was exactly sports, but I guess in the law that legalized sports betting, there's some wiggle room that let you bet on Oscar bets. I'm not exactly sure how that occurred.
Well, just a final question to you, John, then. As you have mentioned several times, New Jersey needs money, is looking for any and all sources of revenue. What's the state of the budget in New Jersey going forward?
So that's a really good question to ask right now. If you recall, there were a few tax increases that were passed last summer as part of the new fiscal year budget. We're now more than halfway into that fiscal year, and the pace of growth is trailing what it needs to be by the end of the fiscal year to make the budget stay in balance. And so we'll know within the next week or so. Governor Murphy is set to put forward his proposal for the next fiscal year budget. And usually when that happens, the Treasury Department sort of rebalances the existing fiscal year budget. Now, April is always the big month for New Jersey. What happens with the income tax collections? The income tax is the biggest source of revenue in New Jersey, and they usually don't know until, say, late April, even into May, whether the income tax met its number. But the income tax has been the one that's been underperforming the most. And there are growing concerns that the state will not be able to live up to the growth rate that it established when the budget was cast in early July. And so if we're in that scenario, there would be either spending reductions or some other adjustment that would have to be made to keep the budget in balance because New Jersey is not allowed to run at a deficit. And not getting
full revenue from
gambling would be huge.
We got to end it there. John Reitmeier, budget and public finance reporter for NJ Spotlight. Thanks, John, for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm Artie Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're coming up on the 40th anniversary of the worst nuclear power plant accident in U.S. history, when in 1979, a reactor at Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania melted down. Pennsylvania is now number two in the country in nuclear power with its five aging plants. Owners are looking for subsidies from the state. Otherwise, they say they will shut the power plants down. They're facing competition from natural gas and renewables. Looks like the ball is now in the legislature's court. So should Pennsylvania taxpayers bail out the nuclear power industry? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. And joining us is Mark Levy. He's an Associated Press reporter who covers Harrisburg. Mark, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with Three Mile Island. There is one unit that is still operational today. Describe what is happening at Three Mile Island currently.
So there's really no disagreement that Three Mile Island is unprofitable in the competitive energy market as it is now. It has one unit since the other stopped operating in 1979. Most nuclear power plants have two units. That makes them far more economical. And so what Exelon, the owner of Three Mile Island, said in 2017 is that we're going to close it in 2019 unless somebody steps up and essentially bails it out. Gives it some sort of subsidy, recognizes it for it being a zero-emission plant. In other words, a power plant that doesn't emit carbon dioxide and make the problem of global warming worse. We're at that point where nothing's happened yet to help it.
We have a little scratchy phone line there, but Mark, we're going to carry on and hopefully we can fix it as we keep going. Just a couple of more questions about TMI. As you said, there's one unit there. It is not profitable as things stand today. How many people work at TMI?
About the last figure I saw, I think it was about 700. Statewide, there's several thousand people who rely on the power plants for their jobs. As you said, you know, Pennsylvania is the number two nuclear power state. There's five nuclear power plants. So what the nuclear power companies are trying to do is to, as they get trying to get help for Three Mile Island, they're saying the same problems that are affecting Three Mile Island will affect all of our nuclear power plants. So anything that's done to help Three Mile Island should be done to help all the nuclear power plants.
Were you alive, Mark, in 1979? I remember that so well.
I was, but I live so far away that I'm not sure I really knew what Three Mile Island was until I moved to Pennsylvania.
Oh, interesting. Tell us then what the owners of Three Mile Island and others, what they want from the legislature.
So what we see now right now in the legislature is a co-sponsorship memo, which is an early form of legislation saying lawmakers would like to give nuclear power the same preferential status that a 2004 law gave to solar power and wind power and a few other niche power sources, in other words, requiring utilities to buy a certain amount of that electricity. So they say that that would fairly recognize nuclear power for its zero emission status, and that would help the power plants at least compete with low-cost natural gas that's flooding the market. There's a lot of resistance to that. In addition to being the number two nuclear power state, Pennsylvania is also the number two natural gas state. The natural gas industry is dead set against any sort of help that keeps nuclear power in business. There's a lot of business groups that are against it, such as large manufacturers, the NFIB. And Pennsylvania is a competitive electricity market state, and that was set into motion two decades ago. And there's a lot of lawmakers who don't want to break faith with that by starting to pick major power plants to give preferential treatment to.
Mark, we're going to call you back. It's just the phone line is going in and out, and it's very frustrating, I'm sure, for our listeners. So once you hang up, we'll call you back. I'll just do a quick recap here. That's Mark Levy. He's Associated Press reporter who covers Harrisburg and parts of Pennsylvania. And we saw an article that he wrote recently titled "Uncertainty Shadows Pennsylvania's Debate Over Nuclear Power." And interestingly, we are coming up on the 40th anniversary of the Three Mile Island accident. As I mentioned, I remember that so well, what that scary time was all about. So we're interested in talking about this debate over funding for nuclear power plants, and it has become an interesting, maybe even a hot topic here in Pennsylvania, with renewables and natural gas becoming increasingly competitive with some of these old facilities. And as Mark was saying, some of these old facilities, they do want some kind of subsidy. In fact, saying that they are essentially zero carbon emissions so that they should get the same kind of subsidies given to renewables. We'd like to know what you think of that. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We've got Mark Levy back, and hopefully, Mark, fingers crossed that this is a better phone line there. So how is this playing in the legislature? As you said, it's more a memo than anything else.
Yeah, so right now it's an early stage. It's a broadly worded memo without details. And the major problem that it has right now is that there are a lot of Republicans in the legislature who don't want to break faith with business groups that are against it, the natural gas industry that's against it. And there's a lot of Democrats who are conflicted about it because they don't want to simply help nuclear power without advancing the goals of solar power and wind energy. It is a very conflicting subject. I'm not sure I've seen anything quite like it in a long time. Exelon is very influential in southeastern Pennsylvania. It's influential with lawmakers from there. But the natural gas industry is also very influential with lawmakers from the rest of the state. you know, top lawmakers right now are staying above the fray. They're not they're not really saying where they are on it. The governor is not really saying where he is on it. He's saying he's concerned for the future of the power plant workers at Three Mile Island. But otherwise, no one has no one in a very high profile has stepped in to try to pull this bill over the finish line. And of course, I think I forgot to mention earlier that that Exelon has given essentially a June 1st drop dead deadline for action to happen, for a bill to be enacted into law before they start shutting down Three Mile Island. And that takes effect on September 30th. And speaking to one of their senior vice presidents last week, he made clear that this was not a flexible date. It's a logistical date, not a political date, is what he said.
Well, so we're talking about a timeline here. I mean, at some point, someone is going to have to step up and make a decision one way or the other.
Yeah, and at some point, someone's going to have to get legislation out there and corral the votes and put together coalitions that will get behind this. And it's not clear if 3 months is enough time for something like that to happen.
Well, interesting, as you mentioned earlier, the people are lining up on various sides. You've got labor unions, you've got business, you've got the natural gas industry, you've got the renewable industry. AARP apparently is getting in on this. And, of course, nuclear power activists, I guess, one way or the other. Does that make this particularly complicated, do you think?
It does. There's a lot of different conflicts here. So you have environmentally minded lawmakers, environmental groups, some of whom are dead set against helping nuclear power, and some who are willing to help nuclear power because they see it as a long-term climate good. What they also want to see happen, though, is to also advance solar power and wind power. So, like I said before, the governor hasn't taken a public position on this necessarily, but his own administration, in a report it published in November, made it clear that if this state is to adhere to the goals of the Paris Climate Accords and dramatically reduce its carbon emissions in the coming decades, that keeping the nuclear power plants open would be a very elemental part of that. I think the governor might be waiting to see what sort of support forms behind this bill. But, you know, what Exelon is saying is that the same ills that are affecting Three Mile Island, which is a competitive energy market that doesn't recognize the value of zero emissions, those ills are also going to affect the other nuclear power plants in this state. There's four others. They all have two generators, so they're more economical. But First Energy out of Ohio owns a nuclear power plant in western Pennsylvania called Beaver Valley, and they have said that they will close it before 2021 unless it gets some sort of help.
So they're really putting some hard pressure here. Let me get some callers in. We've got Brad from, looks like, Haddonfield. Brad, go ahead. You're on Radio Times, or Hatfield, I should say.
Hi. My dad worked for General Electric in the nuclear power group as a designer of nuclear reactors for 30 years. And after he retired, he became a bit of, you know, against nuclear power because just the way it's handled, he had no objection to its use, but the way the cleanups and the management of the facilities and the NRC is run, he became a bit of a gadfly and a pain in the side to them, continually writing letters to the New York Times and numerous newspapers in the country. But with one of the things that's being overlooked in this is the long-term cleanup responsibilities. You know, they were supposed to set aside funds for cleanup. There's a company that's offering to come in and do the cleanup for them. You know, they'll get a part of the fund. The power company gets to liquidate the fund, and these guys promise to do the cleanup at a reduced cost with a technology that's not even existing yet and a cost that no one really understands. And the ratepayers and the taxpayers are going to be left holding the bag to do the cleanups on these nuclear power plants.
Well, Brad, I appreciate the call. And let me just let me see if Mark Levy can respond in any way to your comment. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. It does take us back. And I should say to our listeners, we are going to do a show marking the actual 40th anniversary of TMI. But, Mark, anything you want to say back to Brad?
I mean, that is the long-term cleanup of nuclear power plants is on the minds of people in this debate, but it's at this point taking a back seat since, you know, the state doesn't really have a role in that. This is a federal issue. So that's taking a back seat to the issues of, you know, do you help a power plant that could possibly make people's bills more expensive? Do you help a power plant for the long-term good of the climate? It's taking a backseat to those issues.
A comment from a listener. He says she says it's astounding to hear someone on your show say that nuclear power has zero emissions, as your guest did just a few minutes ago. Whether it's 25,000 years or 25 million years, the half life of the emissions means that nuclear energy has permanent emissions. And it is interesting, the descriptions that I have read, Mark, about the emissions coming from nuclear, I think depending on perhaps which side of the issue people are on, some see it as zero, some see it as our listener does here with emissions that take us into the future.
And that's exactly the reason why people who care about the climate are conflicted about nuclear power, is because of the cleanup involved.
Right, exactly. Also, a comment from Eric. Nuclear is obviously not competitive with solar and wind as well as gas. There is no reason to subsidize it. And Mark, I'm sure that's one of the arguments that you're hearing on this issue.
Yeah, so, you know, the first thing out of the mouth of a lot of opponents of this is that they don't want to make electricity bills more expensive for the sake of one power plant when you have a natural gas industry in the state that's thriving and but also is looking for more buyers of its power. And natural gas sees that if nuclear power plants are kept in business, that's less of a market for natural gas.
And do we know if the legislature says, okay, we will give you your subsidies, what will it cost ratepayers in Pennsylvania? Do we know?
We don't know. There's no way to know until really you see a bill with more particulars in it. Right now, like I said before, it's just a co-sponsorship memo, which is a broadly worded concept saying we'd like to add nuclear power to the 2004 law that required utilities to, you know, buy certain niche forms of power like wind and solar. So it just depends on how much. It sort of depends on long-term forecasts on where the electricity market is going.
But it seems, based on about a minute, Mark, before we have to say goodbye, but it seems that a decision has to be made in the next couple of months, because the threats, at least coming from the nuclear industry, is that we will shut these places down if we don't get what we want.
Right now, Three Mile Island is the one that is going to shut down, according to Exelon, this year. Beyond that, the other nuclear power plants are viewed as profitable, at least in the short term. First Energy out of Ohio says Beaver Valley will stop being profitable in the next 2 or 3 years. So if lawmakers let Three Mile Island shut down, it could be that within another year or two, there will be another deadline that they're working against to save another nuclear power plant. So if nothing happens this spring, there will be future deadlines in the future, it seems.
Well, Mark Levy, thanks for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he's AP reporter, covers Harrisburg, talking about some ideas about bailing out the nuclear power industry here in Pennsylvania. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.